Well, I'm doubly humbled by this, giving this lecture today. First of all, I never thought I would ever be chosen for this in 1,000 years. Here I am. I stand here before you. It amazes me that this occurred, and I'm very grateful for the honor. And I was also humbled by the challenge of writing this lecture, which I found alternately excruciating and exhilarating. It's a very strange venture. Philosophers are really not trained or told that they should be autobiographical at any point of their lives. There's only one exception. That's the series of books of which I'm on the board, actually. The series of philosophers is edited out of Carbondale. What's it called? Yeah, Library of Living Philosophers. I should know. I read a lot of the manuscripts for this. That's the only other occasion I can think of where you're systematically asked to talk about your career and especially your thought. Let's give it a try. The title of this lecture, which didn't make it into the program through no fault of the program committee, is A Life in Three Stages, More or Less. In What is Philosophy? Deleuze and Guattari suggest that the moment comes in the life of a philosopher when one can finally and frankly ask, what is it that I've been doing all my life? This very basic question is one that most philosophers never raise as such. It has been obscured by a career in which, quoting again, there has been too much desire to do philosophy. Doing it by active engagement in writing and teaching, leaving no time to ask what one has really been doing all the while. This occasion, that of the Jean Dewey lecture, invites me to ask myself, well, what have I been doing with my time in philosophy? In other words, it allows me to catch up with myself and to let you catch a glimpse of what I've been up to all these years. I see my life in philosophy as having unfolded in three stages. The first was a period of privileged isolation. For high school, I went to an all-boys private school in Asheville, North Carolina, far from my home in Topeka, Kansas. The Dickinsonian bleakness of that setting at least left a lot of time for reading, well outside of and beyond the classes. Being on the honors list, I was allowed to go into the town of Asheville on Saturday afternoons, 2 hours a week, the one reprieve in an otherwise very demanding schedule. And on one of these expeditions, I bought a copy of Santayana's Skepticism and Animal Faith. At age 15, I devoured the book, fascinated by the way the flowing prose laid out what it is to know something and what the limits of knowing are, and how we must trust our brute and primary perception of the world. It wasn't so much Santayana's arguments that intrigued me as the fact that someone of such evident intelligence could raise such probing questions, questions I had never asked myself until then, but that instantly seemed to be exactly the right questions, those I should be asking myself if I had half a mind. Half a mind. That's all I felt I had as a first-time reader of philosophy. I still have that feeling reading new authors like Gilles Deleuze most recently. How to move to a place where I could raise searching questions as my own probe head. That day seemed far away, but I had drunk the Kool-Aid that might someday get me to that point, which was to be many years later in sober fact. Before I could reach that moment, I had to learn much more about the field I had so inadvertently entered in that downtown Asheville bookstore. This took the form of an undergraduate major in philosophy at Yale, where Richard Bernstein was my most inspiring teacher. He instilled in his students a profound sense of the romance of philosophy. That's the title of his Dewey Lecture of 2006. Bernstein had a special genius for engaging members of his class in the most pressing questions. What is freedom? What are its limits? And he engaged us in large part because he was so deeply engaged himself in these same questions. I had developed an interest, as Drew mentioned, in psychoanalysis already, and he encouraged me to bring Freud into dialogue with Kant, leading to a senior thesis entitled Freedom in Psychoanalysis. To what extent does psychopathology inhibit free will? Is there a residual freedom under the symptoms that otherwise dominate one's daily life? Not surprisingly, these were really questions that I was posing to myself in the neurotic misery of that time of life, late undergraduate years. My treatment was deeply flawed, but the effort introduced me to the rigors of working out my own ideas in the face of formidable thinkers. It also helped me to realize that there are no easy, much less definitive answers to the most basic questions. I was introduced to the special challenge of asking such questions in the light of findings from other fields, in my case, psychoanalysis. I had been drawn to psychoanalysis in part from my childhood in Topeka, a major center for psychiatry in that era. My father was the legal counsel for the Menninger Foundation, and I had worked there myself as a part-time art therapist in the summers. My sister's sudden psychotic breakdown in the summer before my sophomore year at Yale, devastating to my parents, deeply disorienting to me, led me to a precipitous decision to become pre-med, hoping I might become a psychiatrist who would understand mental illness better, as well as helping those who were thus afflicted. My senior year, I had to decide between this career path and teaching philosophy, and I had two other choices. City planning, oddly enough, which was a very hot topic in those days, and becoming an artist. In the spring of senior year, just as I was finishing my essay on freedom, I was at a very confusing decision point and close to breakdown myself, not knowing which way to go. Just before graduation, I heard that I had been awarded a Carnegie Teaching Fellowship for the next year. This fellowship, unthinkable in the current academic world and climate, was designed to deflect those heading for a standard profession such as medicine or law into a career of teaching. It offered a generous stipend for the time, $3,500 for the whole year to live on, and the opportunity to teach one class each semester as well as to attend graduate courses in one's home institution. This sudden windfall was for me the kairotic moment. By the following spring, there was no question that I would pursue a career in philosophy. Not because teaching was easy, it was exceedingly demanding, and it still is, or because writing philosophy was any easier. Rather, I just saw no other way to go. Visiting Professor Stephen Kerner had told me the year before, when I encountered him in the Yale library and described my agonizing over what I should do in the future, he said, "Don't go into philosophy unless you feel you must do so." Very good advice, indeed. In the spring of 1962, I experienced just the sense of necessity Kerner had singled out as the decisive criterion for making philosophy my career. From that moment on, I knew I had found my métier, not from any feeling of special talent, but just because, again, I could do no other. Much the same sense of necessity has served as a guidepost for me in later years, and it works the other way around too. For example, even when, a decade later, I decided to undertake training at a psychoanalytic institute, it was clear to me that I would never practice as an analyst. It was not necessary to practice, since it became evident to me that it was the theory of unconscious mental process that drew me to undertake this training. This was confirmed by my interest in Jacques Lacan, whose seminars I had attended in the mid-1960s in Paris, and whom I invited to Yale in 1975 for his only American expedition. Lacanian theory was scintillating and revolutionary in the world of psychoanalysis. But again, I experienced no need to become a Lacanian analyst. At the time of the Yale lecture, I divert into the following episode, Lacan happened to be into a fascination with knots, rope tricks, as models of unconscious primary process. And he confounded the large audience who had come to hear his public lecture by first declaring that I am here to tell you that Socrates was a male hysteric, and then proceeded with no further comment or explication to tie and untie wordlessly knots with the help of an assistant on the stage. After 45 minutes, most of the audience was gone, leaving Lacan on stage with his assistant amidst an increasing pile of convoluted knots, Borromanian knots. Quite actually sophisticated knowledge of topology was here revealed. The exact relationship to the structure of the unconscious was never articulated. Not that evening, anyway. So thus went the first phase of my life in philosophy. Looking back, I realize with a critical edge how advantaged a life this was, how much I benefited from the privilege of being upper middle class, from being white, and from being educated in a private high school and college in the midst of males only, both high school and college. Asheville and Yale, for all their educational merits, were perfect breeding grounds for the kind of obliviousness to being white and being male that George Yancey singled out in his recent Letter to White America. Some of you must have read it in the last few weeks. Had I read such a letter at that time, I would have been uncomprehending. Now, however, I get it, and I wonder why I failed for so long to understand what Yancey sets forth so lucidly. In short, I took being white and male for granted as unmarked positions in the larger social nexus. Of course, so did many members of my generational cohort. The questions of gender and racial identity were mute for many of us, despite our proclivity for asking searching questions. Philosophy was presented in that era as almost wholly an endeavor by white, European, and American men. The inclusion of women, much less of people of color, was not on the agenda. It is from the standpoint of the present moment's focus on issues of identity and intersectionality that I can regret my unconsciousness at that time. Regret it, I do. Unconsciousness, especially in such vexed matters as race or sex, is never a good thing at any time, whatever the exact conditions under which it occurs. If I had an interest in social and political matters in those early years, it was more from a spirit of noblesse oblige than from any deeper empathic ties with those who had experienced no such protected lives. For such a failure, I do not hold my upwardly mobile middle-class parents responsible. They were struggling to give their son a head start in a world that no longer knew the deprivations of the Great Depression from which they had suffered when they were young. Nor can I begin to indict my teachers. I was very lucky to study with the likes of Wilford Sellers, Paul Weiss, George Schrader at Yale, and John Wilde and William Earle at Northwestern. These were all extraordinary educators, and I was extremely fortunate to be their student, but none of them was politically engaged. The exception was Bernstein, who went to Mississippi in the summer of 1964, and who brought the young Martin Luther King Jr. to the Yale campus as early as 1958. When I heard him, I was a freshman in a small chapel. I was moved by King's quiet eloquence and by his knowledge of Hegel, on whom he had recently completed a PhD dissertation at Boston University, much more, frankly, than by any determined political stance he took in that talk. The fault for the oblivion lay with myself. I failed to engage myself in the great social and political issues of the time in any direct and committed way. I was in Paris on a Fulbright in the early Vietnam era, and I left there 2 years before May 68. Not only did I miss out on the major political events of that tumultuous time, I evaded them by my intense continuing studies, evaded them in effect, if not in conscious intent. There were a few exceptional moments, From Paris, I wrote a letter that was published in the New York Times in 1966, defending King's critique of the Vietnam War, a critique the Times had dismissed out of hand in an editorial. But I was not on any of the front lines in this epic of demonstrations and rising political consciousness. And I pause here to wonder, how did I fall victim to such blindness and paralysis? The fault cannot be laid to the institutions of which I was a part in those early years, even if they were actively complicitous in promoting a sense of satisfied well-being among their students and faculty. Kingman Brewster, who became president of Yale at about the time when I returned to teach there in 1968, was publicly supportive of justice for the Black Panthers in the famous New Haven trial. And my African-American colleague and friend, Ken Mills, was outspoken in student demonstrations that I attended that year and the next. But still, where were the roots of my larger failure to take a more actively participatory role in the events of the day? One root lay in the fact that the kind of philosophy I was practicing in those years, writing what Paul Ricoeur once told me was an eidetics of the imagination, was not at all concerned with locating the philosopher who wrote such things. But a deeper source lay in my willingness to allow the recognition and support I was receiving at that time from various sources, universities and fellowship committees. I had a Fulbright to study in Paris for 2 years in the mid-60s, as I mentioned. All that gave me a sense of a false sense of self-confidence. Was I not doing things right or right enough by receiving such attention, including job interviews at Stanford, Duke, and University of California and Santa Barbara, when I was first looking to teach after I received my doctorate from Northwestern in 1967? That was a different day, and that was a different job scene, you can be sure. Well, I had graduated into the world of academia, and this world became, for me, a place that stood apart from the social movements of the time. It's now possible for me to see that I accepted the all-too-common academic habit of trading on the prestige of the institutions at which I had been a student and later a young faculty member, accepting the professional stroking that was due as much to this prestige as to any merit of my own. I was, in effect, taking a ride, a free ride offered to me as white, male, and upper middle class. And buoyed up by my advantages, I had never earned, and of whose social reality I was only marginally aware, I withdrew into the halls of higher learning in New Haven, Evanston, and Paris. At Oxford in 1972 to 1973 on a special fellowship, I was writing the first of a series of books that were meant to be rigorous phenomenological studies of imagination, memory, feeling, and thinking. I originally projected these four books. I managed, as Drew mentioned, to write the first text in this series and half of the second when things began to change radically in my life. So in this second period, the bubble burst within the world of academia where I had been so comfortably situated. I experienced my first immersion in a concerted political struggle. In this case, the struggle occurred within the academy rather than without. It took the form of a bitter and pitched battle over the future identity of the Yale Philosophy Department. Ruth Marcus had arrived from Northwestern, determined to change the public face of that department from the open-ended pluralism of the 1950s and 60s to a more narrowly focused analytical tenor. I defended my friend David Carr in a long article in the New York Times after he had been berated publicly by Marcus in department meetings and in the public media. I paid a price for this gesture of support. Marcus saw to it that I was denied tenure when I came up the following year. This was, of course, in effect, nothing but a petty politics of contention and retribution. Nevertheless, it was a chapter in realpolitik that profoundly affected my life. I realized for the first time that philosophy is not the benevolent institution I had assumed it to be from my fortunate early experiences in the field. It was a fraught field filled with winners and losers, with stakes higher than I had imagined in my protected years as a student and instructor. It was in the same period of time, now the early 1970s, that the pluralist movement emerged in the Eastern APA, a movement dedicated to contesting the growing hegemony of analytical philosophy in the U.S. I joined this group with a new sense of political purpose, determined to secure an open berth and fair treatment for continental and other forms of non-analytical philosophy in America. This was my first full immersion in political work for a cause which I was convinced was just. I actively participated in covert planning sessions led by Bruce Wilshire and John Locke and others, devising strategies for bringing about these aims, which eventually led to the democratization of the APA at every level, selection of committees, full recognition of the specialized societies, and main program events whose topics were designed to engage both analysts and pluralists. By the time I became president of the APA in 2010, this work had been mostly accomplished. Accomplished, that is, for the most part, though it remains the case that, quote, eternal vigilance is the price of justice, to modify an archetypal epigram chiseled on the facade of the National Archive building here in Washington. The original words were, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Well, meanwhile, I had to find a job. I was out of work. After the Yale debacle of 1975, I had the great good fortune of being offered a position at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. This was to prove liberating in several basic ways. I returned to painting in a serious way at that very moment, having set aside this activity from the time of boarding school. It was really 20 years later. But I took it up again. My writing also took a new turn as my book on memory, as Drew had mentioned, moved from the narrow confines of a mentalistic model to a recognition of the role of body and place in memory, two very concrete dimensions neglected in all earlier accounts of remembering. A lecture I gave at SPEP in 1983 had the title, Keeping the Past in Mind. The point of it was that memory cannot be kept in mind, or for that matter, in the brain. It must be sought elsewhere, in actual bodily engagements and in the concrete places where these engagements are situated. It's as much around us as in us. This was the opening move in two decades of writing on the neglected importance of place in philosophy. I felt I had found a bedrock that had lain concealed for much too long underneath the machinations of mind, with an infatuation with sensation and the analytics of language in modern philosophy. But being at Stony Brook had yet another, still more salutary effect. I was now at long last in a scene of genuinely public education, the kind of education that Dewey had long advocated and that was forcefully expressed in his remarkable book, Democracy in Education. It is shocking to me in retrospect that I did not begin to come to grips with the public sphere of educational praxis until I arrived at Stony Brook in 1978. I had spent literally the previous 24 years in exclusively private institutions. I found the undergraduates at Stony Brook altogether lively, intensely challenging, much more challenging than anything I had encountered at Yale, Northwestern, or other places. They were much more outspoken and willing to contest the views of their fellow students and of their teachers. These students were often, and still are, the offspring of first and second generation immigrants to this country, many of whom had settled on Long Island and in the New York boroughs. Their energy, their passion, their deeply caring for finding the truth about any given issue led me to realize that the classroom can be a very different kind of place compared to the staid environment to which I had become accustomed in my previous experience as a student and teacher. At the same time, the graduate students at Stony Brook were extraordinarily committed to creative, first-order philosophy, and they inspired me to articulate my own thoughts on matters of place and time, body and art. Along with my participation in the pluralistic movement, all this constituted what I would call the first stage of my great awakening. Another dimension of this awakening was my beginning to teach alongside women colleagues for the first time, women of considerable intellect and deep commitment to issues of social justice. I have in mind Eva Cate and Mary Rawlinson in particular. They were joined later by Kelly Oliver and all too briefly, Linda Olcoff. In their presence, any sense I had had that philosophy is exclusively a male enterprise melted quickly into thin air. I became conscious of myself as a male professor with all the privileges that this brings with it. And it soon became clear to me that women are not only the equals of men in philosophy, but often superior. More original, more perspicacious, more persistent, more able to discern the inherent relationality of human lives. Eva Cate's work on disability in particular was a major revelation and allowed me to reconsider my sister's lifetime of suffering in a new light. Other revelations arose later from Mary Rawlinson's pioneering work on the global labor market and its effect on food production and consumption, from Anne O'Byrne's writings on the importance of natality, genealogy, and genocide, and from Megan Craig's current focus on the end-of-life care. In my growing appreciation of the merits of my female colleagues, I was coming to engage in another form of political work. I was overcoming a sexist view that had rendered me blind to these merits in earlier years. From these women and others, I came to a very different vision of doing philosophy in a more communitarian model, that of a multi-voiced body, to use Fred Evans' telling phrase, which emphasizes the other's well-being rather than one's own primarily. I gained a vision of philosophy that was less egocentric and monocentric than I had imbibed from the transcendental strains in Husserl and Heidegger in the early Sartre, and that my own life up to then had unconsciously exemplified. Also integral to this vision and a crucial component of my new life at Stony Brook was the realization that different races belong integrally to the same multi-voiced collective body. Thanks to this more expansive sensibility, when I was chair of my department at Stony Brook in the mid-90s, I actively recruited two African-American philosophers to join our department, Harvey Cormier and Lorenzo Simpson, and I strongly supported the efforts of my colleague Gary Marr to create courses in Asian-American philosophy as well as an Asian-American center in the halls of our department. At a later point, I was delighted that Eduardo Mendieta brought Latin American philosophy to prominence in our department, its offerings, and its public face. All that, my coming to Stony Brook, where I'm still happily ensconced, was the second stage of my life in the discipline. And the third phase, this represents no grand synthesis, but something that has often taken the form of what could be called dual pursuit. Indeed, my whole time in philosophy has seen several sorts of such pursuit. First, philosophy in psychoanalysis, then philosophy in painting, culminating in an exhibition of my work 2 years ago in New York City. But more recently, a third form of such doubling has occurred. This is philosophy and engaged political action. I'm in the midst of this now, having come to it recently and under the direct inspiration of my partner, Mary Watkins. As we have seen, the isolation and privilege of my earlier career kept me, I kept myself, at a distance from the most searing events of those troubled times. Despite this, my political heart wasn't the right place. I was never anything but liberal, sometimes radical in my thinking. I did join demonstrations and marches at critical moments. For instance, quite a few protests at the UN against the Chinese genocide and culture site in Tibet. and with many of you present, the massive march against the invasion of Iraq in February 2003. Still, a full-fledged praxeological component was missing. I had no coherent agenda in the political realm, just strong beliefs. I remained at the level of doxa rather than informed praxis. I was quite aware of this, perplexed by it, yet remained strangely still, in effect, immobilized. It was as if writing and teaching and my growing family, who were in Connecticut while I was teaching on Long Island, took up all my fiercely focused attention, leaving little extra energy for action in the wider world. Or at least, that's what I told myself. Now, all this changed when, quite recently, I began to spend serious time at the U.S.-Mexico border in the company of Mary. At first, we made repeated visits to particular cities along the wall, Tijuana, Nogales included, several times, but eventually we decided to travel along the entire border from Brownsville to San Diego. Everywhere, we saw the indelible signs of a monstrously outsized structure propped up by continual construction at a massive border patrol, all to the tune of many billions of dollars and untold human suffering. Yet it was not in any way clear that the wall was effective in its purported mission to control immigration from Mexico and Central and South America. Many managed to get over or around the wall, though many also died in the effort. Thousands literally perishing and still perishing in the deserts of Texas and Arizona. And to what purpose? Why limit drastically the numbers of workers who are fleeing from dire economic poverty, often a poverty often generated by the actions of the U.S. itself, most conspicuously in the case of the NAFTA Accord of 1994, but many other actions since then. The majority of those seeking entry to the United States had no intention of remaining in this country, contrary to the fears of conservative critics. The vast majority of those who chose to remain in the U.S. have become exemplary members of U.S. society. The manifest injustice in this circumstance, combined with its very high financial, human, and political costs, convinced Mary and myself that we should write a book setting out our considered perspective on this tragic and self-undermining, self-defeating situation. This became the book that Drew had mentioned, Up Against the Wall, Reimagined the U.S.-Mexico Border Wall, published last year. We found ourselves also in outspoken opposition to walling out forced migrants anywhere and wanted to warn against this proclivity worldwide. Unfortunately, as you know, the evil proliferation of the impulse to wall out the other, most conspicuously today in Europe, is now all too apparent. This book represents a decided step in the direction I'm here identifying as the third step in my evolving life and philosophy. Other recent writings have pointed in the same direction: the study of racism at the border, the experience of prisoners, and solitary confinement with respect to the body and place of this radical subjection, and an essay on the Occupy movement from the perspective of its specifically spatial dimension, that is, the parks as well as the streets where occupation took place. Currently, as I have mentioned, I am seriously considering teaching philosophy in prison, following a path first blazed courageously by Glenn Mazes and Drew Leader some 20 years ago. Especially as set out in Drew's eloquent testimony to that experience, the great book, The Soul Knows No Bars. Doing this is the only commitment, frankly, that might lure me into partial retirement, which I have been steadily resisting on every other ground. To do this, to take up philosophy in prison, would be not just another chapter in my history of ambidextrous activities. It would represent a fundamental reorientation of my life, including my life in philosophy. But even if it were to become my primary preoccupation, it would not mean leaving the profession, but pursuing philosophy by other means and in other places. It would be the actional equivalent of political theory in the spirit of William James's idea of the moral equivalent of war, except that practical action would now take precedence over speculation. It would mean a reversal in my life in philosophy, not a reversal to the opposite, not a case of enantiodromia in Heraclitus's pungent term, that is, radical reversal into the opposite, but an organic turning toward that which I missed, that which I failed to do, that to which I was blind in the opening years of my immersion in our field. This last phase would be the actualization of the way not taken earlier, undertaken at long last with decisiveness and from a strong sense of felt necessity. Well, fine, you may be saying to yourselves, I'm glad that Ed has finally awakened from his long, sheltered, dogmatic slumber and come around to a more responsible social and political consciousness. But you might well also be wondering, so what does this have to do with his practice of philosophy and with phenomenology, in particular my chosen field of specialization? In the case of John Dewey, notice and remember that there was a manifest link between his extensive social and political engagement and his brand of experimental pragmatism. For him, philosophy takes its rise from what he liked to call a problematic situation. And it's in and through, and only in and through, such a situation that one begins to think philosophically rather than from abstract concepts or formal systems. In fact, it turns out that phenomenology also takes its cues from situations in the surrounding world that occasion wonder, that ancient word that was spontaneously re-employed by Husserl, by Eugen Fink, and by Merleau-Ponty in different places. Now, these situations may not always be problematic for phenomenologists, but they must be such as to elicit what Heidegger calls the question of being, that is, the question of how things are in relation to how they might be. From there, it's not a giant step to considering how things should be different. And with the latter, we take ourselves directly into ethical dilemmas and political challenges that act to engage us in our core. This is not a matter of crossing the line from fact to value. In phenomenology, facts as facts have already been suspended, and values are not objective anyway. Instead, everything that matters is embedded in the life world, immanent in this world. In my view, doing phenomenology means returning to what Husserl called the sphere of immanence, already in Ideas 1913. But where Husserl meant by this domain of pure consciousness, the sphere of immanence was that sheer consciousness, immanence in the hands of his successors came to mean the realm of concrete sensibility and material praxis. The life world, in short. When immanence is expanded in this way, it draws upon Sartre in the Critique of Dialectical Reason, in his idea of the practico inert, Nancy in his being singular and plural, his idea of being with, and especially Deleuze in several major works. Deleuze himself refers pointedly and technically to the plane of immanence, by which he meant a level of being in which everything is immanent in it, but it, the plane itself, is not immanent in anything else. Spinoza was the first great immanent thinker, according to Deleuze, and is still unsurpassed. As Deleuze puts it, this plane, however differently construed by different thinkers, quote, constitutes the absolute ground of philosophy, its deterritorialized earth, the foundation on which it creates its concepts. Transcendences of every kind, including what philosophers traditionally call objects and subjects, are nothing but expressions of a displaced immanence. The plane of immanence itself contains nothing reified or static. It is the realm of sheer becoming, and its ontological status is that of virtuality. Deleuze came to call immanence pure, that's his term, but on my construal, immanence is altogether concrete, altogether engaged, and composed of bristling singularities. If my work belongs to any single strand of phenomenology or post-phenomenology, it is to this immanentist tendency. Again, after my first work on imagination, which takes us out of the imminent into a mode of momentary transcendence by way of what I like to call, in those years, its thin autonomy, I came increasingly to examine circumstances by which human experience is characterized by deeply immanent factors that have deep autonomy, such as body in place, glance and edge. Each of these parameters of lived experience takes us into the meshwork of things, states of affairs, and entire situations, each in its own way. Our bodies are the very means of insertion into the immanent, not just as instruments, but by their immersive powers. Places are in turn where we get immersed, the locus of corporeal involvement. It is by glances that we find our way about the immediate scene in which we find ourselves, and by which we pick out the marks of the presence of other beings that co-occupy the same scene. And the scene itself comes densely edged, not only by horizons and other perimeters, but from within by a tissue of densely packed edges. Thanks to the dynamic assemblage of all four factors, we dive into the wreck in Adrian Rich's resonant phrase. We live in the midst of animate and inanimate entities of the most diverse sorts. These include, and especially include, though not exclusively include, other human beings. The more deeply ensconced we become, the more situated in immanence, the better are we able to take account of those of our kind who have special needs. These needs can be physical or psychical, or less dramatically, but also importantly, needs of companionship, friendship, recognition, or support. To do phenomenology as I'm here envisioning it is to be descriptively responsible to the domain of immanence, not for the sake of a catalog raisonné of human needs or their mere typology, but to be sensitive to these various needs in ways that call for response on our part. That is, to be moved to do something so as to meet, or at least to try to alleviate, the manifest needs of those with whom we share the life world at this deeply immanent level, which is our level, the level of all of us, however diversely configured and populated it may be, and however differential our responses to it can be. Here, fact and value merge to the point that we cannot tell their difference in any definitive way. Here, down here below, in the title of Abby Lincoln's great song, we live in immanence together. This includes those who may be indifferent to the tribulations of others, not from malice, but from not having an extended empathic outreach to these others. Part of teaching, and not just in the classroom, is to inculcate more adequate sensitivities to what other human beings are undergoing, not so as to instill a sense of infinite responsibility to the other, as on a Levinasian model, but so as to encourage a more acute awareness of what we can do to intervene, to offer help when this is appropriate, and also equally important, to engage in self-critique when one realizes the damaging syndromes into which one oneself has often unwittingly, but nevertheless destructively fallen, such as sexism, racism, and nationalist chauvinism. Yancey's Letter to White America and A Rigorized Ethics of Sexual Difference are exemplary efforts to instill such self-critique. They carry forward Paulo Freire's project of a pedagogy of conscientization. This pedagogy, notably, was for the people, initially the impoverished and illiterate people of Brazil, but for the people such that this pedagogy is designed and enacted in ways that are culturally specific to those who benefit from it, not from a model imposed upon it by some system of thought, notably Western philosophical thought. Turning now to the last phase of this talk. In my own case, I was forcefully inducted into the immanent sphere of human needs by becoming my sister's permanent caretaker. After our parents died when we were both in our early 20s, I was suddenly in the role of loco parentis for Connie for the rest of her life. some 50 years. In this role, not only did I come to know the netherworld of psychosis with all its confusions and unintelligibilities and of anger and rage on my part as well as hers, I was inducted into the world, a very large world indeed, a vast population of the mentally ill, forced to face the systematic neglect to which seriously disturbed individuals are subject in American society today. After the closing of state mental hospitals in the wake of Reagan's reign as governor of California, contemporary with the advent of mass incarceration and the war on drugs inaugurated at just the same time, many former patients found themselves on the street or in board and care homes. My sister's fate was the latter. Even if not as risky as being homeless, it was not a happy solution. Connie found herself thrown together with other deeply troubled souls who had no competent care in such homes. My sister would often rebel against these degrading circumstances, precipitating her forcible eviction from one board and care home to another over many years, therefore requiring desperate, urgent searches to find the next place to live. I recount this not for its dramatic tenor, nor to elicit your sympathy. I cite it because what it taught me and what I gained from it. Because of my sister's perilous situation, I was drawn into very intense scenes of suffering human beings, where I came to know those who were the victims of a state of mind which few understood and for which no fully effective cures were or are now available. I was ushered into the presence of many whom I came to admire for their pluck and outright courage in the face of formidable obstacles and the absence of anything like what many of us would regard as a good life. I came to realize how much those who are not similarly afflicted take mental health for granted, and also how much many people cower behind a claim to being normal when their own psychical abnormality is manifest or lurks just under the surface, even if not diagnosed in any easy to recognize syndrome. Being in the company of my sister, I learned of the fragility of what Carl Menninger called the vital balance. For many, any such balance is not only elusive, but altogether unattainable. I am supremely grateful to my sister and to her fellow and sister sufferers in the world of the mentally ill for all I learned and came to appreciate in that world. Being part of her troubled life gave me an education of its own, fully as valuable as my extensive formal education in philosophy itself. It was an education in the range of human suffering on the part of those diagnosed as psychotic and more particularly schizophrenic or schizoaffective, as Connie was finally said to be. The suffering was not only mental, of course, but it extended into every domain of the life of such subjects, physical obesity being rampant among this population due to the side effects of antipsychotic drugs, economic, of course, most of the folks with whom Connie was living, and whom I came to know, were living on a skimpy SSI check of less than $1,000 a month, and of course it included abusive treatment at the hands of uncaring helpers in board and care homes throughout the nation, not only California, but I've come to learn everywhere. Connie gave me the immense gift of showing me radically different ways of being in the world. These were ways that were barely dreamed of in my philosophy, even if my chosen manner of practicing philosophy came to make room for them. My explorations in philosophical psychology, in writing as in teaching, gained a dimension they would never otherwise have possessed. A measure of how much I owe to my sister is the fact that her recent and sudden death left me bereft in a very special way. It made me realize how much I had come to need her out of my own need to accompany her in her desperate life. Second person needs, in the phrase of a recent dissertation defended at Stony Brook brilliantly by Katie Wolf. A life spent in increasing immersion in imminence, whether in the public domain or in relation to the needs of a family member, proceeds according to literally immeasurable criteria and in keeping with an unpredictable calendar. The simple truth is that as I had to go into philosophy, so I had to take care of my sister. Despite all the manifest differences between the two situations, being my sister's lifetime keeper was as definitive of my adult life as was my and is my pursuit of philosophy. So caring for my sister thrust me into a world of intense eminence, took me there body and soul in a manner that is strikingly parallel to the move to the density and force of the eminent that I find to be continental philosophy's deepest and most original and valuable thrust, from Husserl, especially the later Husserl, to Merleau-Ponty, to Nancy, and to Deleuze and Irigaray. Or more directly, it catapulted me into this world before my philosophizing caught up with it. The labor of my slowly evolving thought was quite far behind compared to this baptism by fire in the world of the mentally ill. In the part of my life devoted to my sister, I was living on the plane of immanence that I came only years later to realize as a consciously held philosophical position. Looking back, I realized that the compartmentalization of my two lives, academic and fraternal, was extreme. Even if I was barely aware of the gap at the time, even if I was only barely aware, in fact, I was doing both because I had to do each. Only gradually, indeed not fully until writing this lecture, in fact, did I come to realize how closely intertwined these lives have been, how much in its own way each life was sending me into immanence. Yet the two modes of immanence, lived and thought, were not altogether disconnected. I now believe that becoming intimately familiar with the world of the severely disturbed prepared the ground for my development as a philosopher who found himself seeking an ever more adequate model of concrete immanence. In that model, there is ample room for tribulation as well as triumph. For on the plane of immanence, whether it is undergone or is conceptually posited, for the plane of immanence is itself able to embrace these extreme states as well as others. That being down here below provides space for all comers, mentally stable or not, color or white, female, male, trans. It calls for a genuinely radical empiricism of the personal and the familial, the social and the political. Again, I quote James, who anticipated so much of what I'm here saying. A certain way of doing philosophy that I pursued over the past half century proves consonant with certain ways of being, of concrete being in the world. Now, it's not the only way to achieve such consonance. Others include Dewey's own model of an engaged pragmatism and the service of radical democracy, as well as Marx's social theory, critical race theory, many forms of feminism, various strands of deconstruction, most notably those pursued by Derrida and Lyotard, and ordinary language philosophy in the hands of Austin and Cavell. Still others are to be found in important strands of Hinduism and Islam and in engaged Buddhism. Across all the differences in these ways of doing philosophy, I see a rich array of inroads into the plane of immanence, and rightly so, for this it is this very dimension of existence that welcomes the full range of ways in which human beings co-inhabit the life worlds they experience so diversely and which they interpret also so very differently. And speaking of the life world, of course, this is also not to mention animals and plants, the vast oceans and the blue mountains constantly walking. If there's any common bond between the otherwise disparate systems of thought just mentioned, it can be found in their employment of what I like to call radical reflection. About such reflection, which he prefers to call hyper-reflection, Merleau-Ponty writes in The Visible and the Invisible that, quote, such reflection must not lose sight of the brute thing and the brute perception and world, and would not finally efface them in favor of something transcendent to them. It must plunge into this world instead of surveying it. It must descend toward it, such as it is, instead of working its way back toward a prior possibility of thinking it, which would impose upon this world, this concrete imminent world, I interpret, in advance, the conditions for our control over it. End of quote. Merleau-Ponty here captures, in his last book, Visible and Invisible, Incomplete Manuscript, the move to the sphere of immanence that I have found to be a light faden, a guiding thread in my own life and philosophy, and indeed in my own life, period. Radical reflection is not just another philosophical method to be arranged with phenomenological bracketing or eidetic variation. It is an entire practice of thrusting oneself, or allowing oneself to be thrust, into the plane of immanence, going down under transcendental conditions of possibility, as well as categories and forms, down to a level of experience that is operative at all times and places, however differently expressed culturally and linguistically. Even if it is best formulated by Merleau-Ponty, in my view, it is by no means peculiar to phenomenology. Radical reflection entails a form of immersion that is at stake in every return to the immanence of the life world, whether that of perception or spontaneous speaking, of mental health or its lack, of injustice or the just life, or just life in the title of Mary Rawlinson's about to appear book, Just Life. The implication is that unless and until we come to terms with this level of experience, this plane of immanence, we cannot cope creatively with the problematic situations that confront us every day and in every phase of life, with all the ways that each of us, no matter how comfortably situated, we must confront the situation that each of us is living on the edge, if not the edge of physical or mental collapse or climate disaster, then that of the oncoming unknown, whatever form it may assume. All this takes time, and finally, a lifetime. No wonder, as Merleau-Ponty adds, quote, little by little, it is the whole of experience that requires reconsideration. Now, if I were to answer in one sentence the question with which I started, what is it I have been doing all my life in philosophy, it would be that all along I've been seeking the right kind of radical reflection, which for me has meant extending the range of phenomenological inquiry beyond the limits charted by the pioneers in the field. But if you ask me, what have I been doing all my life, including but also apart from philosophy, I would have to say that I have been looking for ways to be an effective presence in all the perilous situations that being an adult brings with it, ranging from the perils of finding a job and tenure, finding a true partner, skirting mental illness, possessing a racism and sexism that doesn't know its own name, and much, much more. These two call for radical reflection, for continual reconsideration of challenging situations, which I need not only to understand better, formally and historically, but to alter materially and substantially in the direction of greater justice. Both modes of radical reflection, understanding and acting, call for engaging ever more actively and discerningly in the plane of immanence that holds both sides of my life together and, I suspect, yours as well. Moving to a conclusion. Just as my voice begins to give out. Erik Erikson, in his discussion of the seven ages of man, says that the last stage of life has two distinctive traits. One is sagacity. This I cannot and shall not claim. The other is gaining the sure sense that one's life had to be so. A striking frame, a phrase. To the latter I can attest. It has been a theme of this talk from the beginning, the sense that I had to go into philosophy, that I had to take care of my sister, and more recently, that I must enter into social and political engagement at long last. None of this has been a matter, of course, of strict necessity. Of course it could have turned out otherwise. I might have become a painter or a psychiatrist or a city planner. But if I did not, This had to do with the fortuitous coalescing of various factors. Finding that book by Santayana, being in Richard Bernstein's class, being awarded the Carnegie Teaching Fellowship, for which, by the way, I never applied. It was just given to me from God knows where. And having a dissertation advisor, Bill Earle, who counseled me after hearing an early lecture of mine that was overstuffed and replete with quotations from Merleau-Ponty and Husserl, who drew me aside after that lecture, my first lecture at SPEP, and said to me, "Ed, you know, it's one thing to be a scholar of continental philosophy, but it's quite another to practice it. Just go out and do it," he said. Bill was the only one of his generation who had done just this himself, and I sought to emulate him. In a certain way, then, my time in philosophy has had to be so. It certainly, in any case, was so. But putting it this way sounds rather too sternly finalistic, too much like it's all over. But this is far from my final act. I'm looking forward to other acts. We have seen that the three stages by which I first schematized my talk today did not hold fast upon further inspection. Aspects of the third stage were anticipated in the second. I'm thinking here of my subjection to the politics of analytical versus continental philosophy, or my participation in the pluralist movement, my first experiences in public education and with women colleagues. And I was already then on the way to the more specific engagements I sought later on. And the long chapter of As My Sister's Companion spanned all three stages, and it directly forecast all that was to come. Well, I'm looking forward now, not to a distinct fourth stage, but to a series of steps, not all of them going in the same direction, but each of which I expect to be as challenging as it is fulfilling. I'd like to think that what Cezanne said about a painting, namely that it should be complete at every stage, even if never finished, complete at every stage, but never finished, holds true as well of my remaining chapters. Never finished, not just as not ending, but as unknowable and deliciously so. I had a premonition of all this recently when I was walking past several sizable polished slabs of marble, each propped up vertically. Looking into some of these very dark surfaces, I could see the bare profile of a body sketched fleetingly on the surface. It was presumably mine, but it gave only a bare silhouette, not any identifying marks by which I might identify myself. Other marble surfaces, more lightly colored, offered no such images, not even such dim ones, and in front of them I had in effect disappeared from view, disappeared from my own view. I'd like to end with the thought that in looking ahead at any time of life, one can only see oneself in a surface darkly, and often not even that. It is the mostly unknown, or the altogether unknown, at which one looks. And it is then that one realizes that the imminence of one's life, one's imminence in life, has been and is both compelling and vanishing, calling one to commit oneself to what is largely, if not entirely, undiscovered. Yet in making this commitment, whether it is to the creation of new philosophical ideas or to the alleviation of others' suffering in the context of social justice, one realizes a form of well-being not otherwise attainable. I'd like to think that philosophy at its best leads us to some such creation and into some concrete form of that alleviation. And I'd like to think also that over a lifetime I have contributed in my own limited fashion to each of these ways of being a philosopher. So there, I think I've almost caught up with myself at last, at least for now. Thank you.